Well, hello, everybody. We're right on time here at Citizens Climate Lobby. So I want to welcome you to the breakout session on methane abatement. My name is Ross Astoria. I am, for my day job, a professor at the University of Wisconsin at Parkside, where I teach courses in introduction to law and environmental policy. I'm also super proud to be a pro bono policy analyst for the Citizens Climate Lobby, and also to be a member of the governing board. Our guest here today is Barry Rabe. Barry Rabe is a professor at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. He teaches courses in environmental politics and policy with a focus on climate. His most recent single authored book is Can We Price Carbon? It is a wonderful, nice, practical, jargon-free evaluation of state-level attempts to price carbon, and I highly recommend it for all climate advocates. Barry has been a frequent presenter, an advisor to me personally and to Citizens Climate Lobby generally. So I want to thank you, Barry, once again for spending some time on Saturday to help me and our advocates and friends get a price on carbon. So thank you for joining us. Barry, I'm wondering if we might begin here, if you might introduce yourself by kind of telling us how you got into studying the policy of climate. You've been doing this for most of your career. What was the kind of initial moment when you said, this is the thing I need to work on?
Ross, first of all, thanks for the introduction. Thanks to you and CCL for inviting me to join you in this conversation. It's always good to be part of this community, and I so respect all the great work that's being done here. In my own case, I'm trained as a card-carrying political scientist trained at the University of Chicago. I took an academic appointment at the University of Michigan and was looking at a range of federalism questions, state versus federal responsibilities, thinking about health, public health, environmental issues. About 20 years ago, I was named the acting dean of a professional school, what was then called the School of Natural Resources and Environment. I was sort of being set up to move into an administrative track to basically let teaching, research, and policy engagement go. And I had this project that I was looking at, why were some states, this is 20 years ago, were some American states on an issue like global warming beginning to unilaterally adopt carbon mitigation policies, a wide, wide range. Some thinking about carbon pricing, others not. And so I kind of got to that proverbial fork in the road where I had to decide, am I going to really give all of this up and walk away from it or go forward with it? And ultimately, as I finished my first book on this topic, which is called Statehouse and Greenhouse, asking why in a global regime some states anyway would engage on this, I was just so fascinated by it, intrigued by it, but also realized I was just taking the first cut at it that I just felt to keep going. And I keep going, realizing that this is an enormously challenging area. We'll never get everything completely resolved. And yet it's one where we all can contribute in our own way. In my way, it's hopefully been through some scholarship and policy engagement. And that was really kind of a turning point for me. I certainly at that point never thought I would stay with it for this long a period of time. And here we are. Well,
thank you for sticking with it. the attraction of an administrative position, you kind of get drawn into it sometime. So we are now over 100 participants about to listen to our discussion about methane. For those of you who might wonder what policy professors talk about when they have beers together, the conversation that Barry and I are about to have is a somewhat choreographed version of the same conversation we had in June when he visited us in Kenosha. So Barry, one thing I do as a policy professor thinking about global warming policy and greenhouse gas mitigation is I start with what I call an emissions profile, which is something like a verbal or graphic description of the sources of the greenhouse gas pollution. So if you could start us off with the sources of methane pollution to get us underway here, please.
Sure, absolutely. And I do recall that prior conversation, Ross, just for the record, we are beer free here today, at least as far as I know. Methane is such an interesting topic, I think, certainly salient right now. And it's one that, in my view, has probably received too little attention in the US and globally on climate issues. Methane is the second most consequential greenhouse gas after carbon dioxide, but there's a significant potency consideration. For its first decades in the atmosphere, a ton of methane has far more global warming impact than does carbon dioxide. And so we think of methane along with hydrofluorocarbons and other short-lived climate pollutants as those that have a very near-term but super intensive impact on the environment and the climate. Over time, unlike carbon, they dissipate. It's generally estimated that about one quarter of the global warming that has already occurred is due to methane from the United States, but from all over the world. And that, I think, has led to a growing interest in a question. If we could take aggressive action to bring those methane numbers down in the short term, would that, if not necessarily buy us time, would that mitigate some of the near-term impacts we're expecting from climate over these next few decades as we continue to work through the carbon crisis? And so methane has really been on the media and policy ascendancy over the last year or so, but it's always been the sort of second banana behind carbon dioxide in most climate conversations.
Right. In particular, economic sectors where methane is emitted include things like petroleum and natural gas systems. And what other sources should we take into consideration?
Sure. So there are multiple buckets, but I think the two really large ones, both from an American standpoint and a global perspective, one is from energy, oil and gas in particular, but also coal. That's production, that's legacy impacts of abandoned operations and the like. And if you put those two together, those areas of fossil fuels together, that's about 40% of the total American methane footprint. About a comparable amount, roughly 38 or 40%, is in the agricultural or livestock sector. Same methane, but different sources, interesting issues as well. The balance involves things like landfills, solid waste, wastewater treatment systems, and other forms and sources. But the two big blocks are really energy related to fossil fuels, which is getting the bulk of policy attention, and then the other piece being agriculture and livestock.
Okay, thank you. And for the participants here, I'm reminded to tell you to send your questions by chat to Elizabeth Dell. So thank you. Now, in the news, there's been some recent flurry of announcements on the international level about agreements to mitigate methane. If you could situate us, our domestic conversation, in that larger international context quickly, please.
Right. So most of the participants here have probably heard in recent weeks, literally, the idea of a global methane pledge. This was something that President Biden launched just weeks ago and has since been trying to secure supporters. The idea of this pledge is to get as many nations of the world to agree to reduce their current levels of methane across all of those sources that I mentioned a moment ago by 30% by the end of this decade, pledging to global efforts to achieve that. I believe at this stage, we've heard from about 90 countries saying that they are on board with this. Our North American partners, Mexico and Canada, many South American countries, the ones that have not engaged yet are China, Russia, and India, and a few other large sources. But we have gone in the international realm, Ross, from really not having a framework to a new initiative that's just a few weeks old, and we're just beginning to unpack what's in those commitments, what they look like, how this is going to relate to the larger Paris process and the like. One other piece that I would just note is that the U.S., this is not the first time the U.S. has engaged in some kind of international or multinational methane agreement. It was 5 years ago when President Obama and the then President of Mexico and Prime Minister Trudeau from Canada agreed in the Three Amigos Summit in Ottawa to agree to across the board reduce our emissions in North America by 45% by 2025. The U.S. has not honored that agreement. Mexico has not honored that agreement. Canada has. And interestingly, there's a new Three Amigos summit that's going to take place just next Thursday. President Biden, President Lopez Obrador, and Prime Minister Trudeau, and my guess would be going back to the climate, but also some of the methane issues will be part of a substantial agenda that they might be revisiting. So there's actually that history of a bilateral or trilateral attempt before.
All right, great. Let's keep our fingers crossed on that collaboration with our North American partners there. Now on to the domestic side of things. So we're climate advocates, mostly working here on the Congress and with federal policy. Kind of what are our options going forward here? I know there's some methane stuff in the Build Back Better reconciliation bill, and I know the EPA is doing some things. But how would you recommend we conceptualize our mitigation opportunities here?
After an extended period where we have squandered both federally and in many states real opportunities on methane, there clearly is some significant movement. If I just would focus right now on the energy sector, particularly oil and gas, there were efforts in the Obama administration to try to use Clean Air Act powers. Almost all of those were reversed or eviscerated by the Trump administration, leaving a fairly limited federal role. That, to a large extent, has left the decisions over methane in state hands, especially oil and gas producing states. Methane has been an issue for a long time in some of these. Texas declared a methane crisis, believe it or not, in 1947, put rigorous regulatory standards into place by 1952. They've never implemented those. They're still in place, but they've never been honored. Most of our production states have really shirked on this, but there are a couple of important exceptions: Colorado, New Mexico, and a few others. That begins to be, just as we see in carbon pricing with the cap and trade experience in RGGI, some early state experience that could create some models for federal engagement. And here in Washington, I think there are two very interesting steps at the moment. In the deep into the weeds of the Build Back Better Act, which I still have a hard time saying quickly, is the fact that there is a methane provision that is a fee on methane. This builds on legislation that was introduced in the Senate by Senators Whitehouse, Schatz, and Booker, familiar names to this audience, back in March. It would put a rather steep fee on methane that would be released across the production chain, this large supply chain, and originally was designed to create a kind of a state-of-the-art monitoring and evaluation system. As that has gone forward, it is stayed in both the House and Senate versions. It's been weakened somewhat. It's been softened somewhat. We can get into the particulars of that if you and others would like to do that, Ross. But the methane fee is still there. This would make the U.S. relatively unique to put an actual price on methane emissions, although there's historic precedent in Norway. Some other developing countries have explored this. Nigeria has used this to try to drive down flaring waste. And our partners in Canada, with their big carbon pricing system, are in the process of trying to transition this to make sure that they're covering CH4 or methane over the next couple of years, especially as the Canadian framework for carbon pricing really ramps up to what potentially could be a very, very high price, among the highest in the world. So that's the legislative path and the fee piece. Before the Glasgow summit convened, EPA announced that it is going to return to the question of using its powers under the Clean Air Act and trying to get a handle on energy sector methane. Methane is not just a greenhouse gas and a potent one, but it can contribute to air quality issues through volatile organic compounds, ozone formation. And so there clearly will be a Biden administration effort to take that administrative route under the Clean Air Act. Of course, all of us are now thinking even more about possible court reactions, given the Supreme Court's decision to review Clean Air Act capacity to be applied to the power sector and possible impacts that might have for transportation, but also methane and the like. So there's really a two-part path here. After squandered years, squandered decades on the methane front, there seems to be a lot of momentum and potentially even a legislative strategy and potentially the magical word of a fee in statute, but it's not there yet.
Very good. Let me ask you one more question about coalition building and environmental justice before we get to the questions from our audience. So now one thing I work think about as a policy professor is not just the amount of abatement that we might get from a policy or the cost, but I also think about the distribution of the cost and benefits from a policy along race lines, gender lines, geographic lines. I think in this case, especially, it's important to think about the coalition and the alliances we're building as we advocate for policy and whether or not there's a way to use methane abatement as a way to help build a coalition. So if you've got some insights on some of the negative impacts that methane might have on environmental justice communities or any other communities that we might pay attention to as we go forward.
No, I really, really appreciate the question, Ross. And this is one that I don't think sufficient attention has been paid. These issues have really kind of drawn me into a much more intensive focus, precisely these questions of equity and fairness and potentially even larger coalition building. One thing that I haven't mentioned thus far is that something that does make methane mitigation particularly attractive is that when you vent or flare methane into the atmosphere, you're permanently wasting a non-renewable natural resource. Methane is the constituent element in natural gas. Release it into the atmosphere, you're just wasting it. You're not even using it for some kind of human benefit. As I've looked around the country and seen discussions on methane emerge, often it's a little different coalition than we might expect. If you think about where drilling and oil and gas drilling takes place in the US currently or historically, and by the way, the current EPA estimates suggest there could be over 3 million existing and current drilling operations scattered all over the United States, although we don't have an exact inventory, and that number keeps going up. Drilling for oil and gas tends not to take place in suburban communities, in affluent areas. It often tends to take place in more intensely urban areas, Los Angeles, Oklahoma City, some very intense issues and equity concerns where you might be compounding air quality issues for a community. But to a very large extent, it also involves more remote and rural districts, those that we don't often associate with support for carbon pricing. I've watched closely over the last 10 years as two states, Wyoming and North Dakota, big oil and gas boom states, which have exempted methane from oil and gas severance or extraction taxes. Coalitions have come in and gone into the state capitals in both Wyoming and North Dakota. This involves ranchers, farmers, local citizens, teachers groups, arguing in many cases that methane is an environmental issue, but it should not be wasted. And when it is wasted, it means that farmers and ranchers and landowners aren't getting their royalty payments. School systems aren't getting their local revenue from royalties that might be placed on extracted revenue or on extracted energy. So these are really unusual coalitions. And at the very point where we're thinking in climate, how to build a broader constituency, how you begin to work across red and blue divides, I actually think methane may have more capacity to achieve a broader coalition than what we have seen to this point in the carbon arena. And I think there's some really, really interesting and exciting opportunities here. And particularly because these are jurisdictions, the oil and gas producing jurisdictions, that are not only worried about their future, but they're also worried about things like site remediation, orphan and abandoned wells. Who's going to pay for that? Where is the technology going to come? And could you even use some revenue for a fee to help clean up a long-standing mess that poses all kinds of safety risks, but also could be spewing small amounts or maybe even larger amounts of methane every day, and there's simply no current detection, which may be why our methane numbers are often so much higher than the reports that we get from industry.
Right, yeah.
So there's a lot here from an environmental justice perspective.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think how a pollutant that has been sort of taken as the second cousin of to carbon pollution has this potentially very fruitful and generative potential to create coalitions. All right, we've got 10 minutes left. Let's take some questions. I see some people texted me directly, but I'm not in a great place to read people's chat. So if you have a chat and a question, please send it to Elizabeth Dell. And Elizabeth, I am going to mute myself now and let you ask some questions.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ross. So there are several questions related to ways of measuring methane leakage and reporting them in a standard and objective way.
This is such an important issue. I'm glad you raised it. I'm glad, Elizabeth, I'm glad so many questions are coming in. Let me make a brief description of where I think that we are at. Most of our measurement for methane in the US, but also true for most oil and gas producing nations, comes from industry reported data, estimates of how much methane is being released at the drill site, point of production, and down supply chains. You can look today at EPA data, Interior Department data, and you'll get numbers. It's also true of most other nations. What we have begun to see over the last 10 years as the technology to monitor through satellites, flyovers, other kinds of monitoring arrangements has gotten better. Take a look sometime at the work the World Bank has done, putting together flaring data from atmospheric data, or the Environmental Defense Fund has done. What we tend to see is what appears to be downward bias. Guess what? When industry estimates how much they're releasing, the numbers are off consistently. There's a general rule of thumb emerging that any number you look at may be an underestimation of 40 to 70%. That's an average. And that doesn't capture super emitters, cases where there's a leak, this type of thing. So one, in answering these great questions, it's important to note that the numbers we have are probably inaccurate and consistently inaccurate below the level of actual release and actual emission. The good news is that there are these technologies that could indeed be put into operation. And so in those jurisdictions that have really achieved very, very low methane loss numbers, Norway, in the US, Colorado, in Canada, British Columbia, guess what? They've aggressively invested in a regulatory regime and a pricing regime to some extent in the Norwegian case. But they've also really pushed the application of state-of-the-art technology to try to get the most accurate numbers possible. This is one of the reasons, frankly, why when Senators Whitehouse, Booker, and Schatz introduced that bill in March, I was thrilled because it had not just a price in it, but also a very sophisticated development of a sophisticated data collection system. I worry that that has likely been watered down as we've gone through subsequent rounds. But the technology is there, it is getting better. And you know, this is also an area where sometimes it's referred to, methane is referred to as the low-hanging fruit of climate change. Another huge advantage is there's a lot of technology to capture and abate and then use that gas. So there are a lot of cost-effective strategies here, lots of technology, but there really has to be the resources and the political will. I actually have a piece coming out on Monday with the Brookings Institution in anticipation of that North American summit that I was mentioning to just a short moment ago. And it ends with a plea that the North American leaders can think about developing a continental-wide system because methane moves back and forth across borders and oil and gas are constantly going up north and south in every possible route. Could North America move from a laggard role here to a real leader, both in reducing methane ultimately, but also being amongst the first places around the world to use the technology that is readily available and put credible numbers up that we can all then begin to understand and work with rather than guess and underestimate the problem? So it's an absolutely terrific question.
Great, thanks for that. Let's see. A related question actually, how would a price on carbon what kind of effect would a price on carbon have on methane emissions?
So the fee, the legislative fee is only for released methane. Mm-hmm. I think a question putting a price on carbon is how you might treat methane. If you flare, if you put a torch at the site of oil and gas production and release methane, in theory, that methane is being converted into carbon dioxide. Guess what? In Norway, that's treated as carbon and it's taxed, and it has been taxed since the 1990s, and there is no specific exemption for methane. In fact, they were extremely careful 30 years ago to write that into statute. So potentially the carbon could be measured and captured that way in the case of a federal carbon tax. I do think the fee on methane itself, though, remains important and significant just because of that much more intensive near-term impact. But I actually think that they could be quite complementary to one another, as long as bills are really capturing more on an upstream standpoint all the methane that might be being released, and particularly those portions of it that are going to get converted into carbon dioxide because they're going to be torched or flared.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gosh, we have a lot of questions from people, so I'm not going to be able to get to everybody's questions. Sorry. But there, let's see, some people have asked about agriculture and you know, how we can address the ag and livestock sectors.
Time to bring in the beer. Just joking. This is another issue, a challenging one, and I don't think we're quite as ready to make progress in it yet, just because of the sensitivity of the questions and the measurement challenges. But we're talking about both the carbon intensity of agriculture and our various practices, and how we might systematically look at the way we grow crops and use energy in growing those crops and fertilizer and that piece of it. There's also, though, this huge piece for livestock, cows, cattle, and pork in particular when we turn to animal protein. There's a lot of research underway. There are a lot of studies underway, and you can begin to look at dietary changes. What would happen if Americans would shift to other protein sources, fish, chicken, turkey, vegetable sources, as opposed to cows and pigs? There's an infinite number of ways to weigh and consider this. There's also some very interesting work being done on methane capture in manure and other kinds of mechanisms. So here it's a little more complicated, but because we're talking about thousands or tens of thousands of cows and separate point sources and farming operations, very difficult issue and harder to really measure with confidence. The technology is a little less applicable, and yet a very, very significant and important question. Here, to my thinking, Elizabeth, the one country in the world that I think has really gotten serious on this is New Zealand. Their largest greenhouse gas emissions are not carbon, but they are methane. And a lot of that comes from their own livestock sector. They're actually looking at bringing in an agricultural and livestock component into their carbon pricing system to weave it into a cap and trade system, because it's just so big and they think it's the only way to go. We're seeing some progress in the current Congress on this with credits for the agricultural sector and the like, but I tend to think that the low-hanging fruit amongst the low-hanging fruit, if you will, short-term, is the energy sector. But we've got to think longer-term about the agricultural and livestock side of this for lots of reasons, both carbon and methane.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we've just got time. We've got less than 2 minutes left. So I'll ask one more question. How will the movement toward greater electrification, much of which comes from natural gas, affect the level of methane emissions? And is there a process to accomplish this with reduced methane release?
Right. You know, so much of the coal to gas transition was predicated on the assumption that the US was capturing most, if not all, of its methane. We now know that that's not true. And so whatever we think of the future of natural gas for heating and electricity, for as long as we use gas in the US or the European Union or anywhere else, getting those methane loss numbers as close to zero as possible is just absolutely crucial. And the numeric differences are just really staggering here. Example, Norway and Mexico have produced about the same amount of oil and gas over the last 5 years. Mexico has released 30 times more methane from those operations. So I would like for us to move to a zero gas platform as quickly as possible, but the methane numbers are really, really very significant. And even if we look at within American production states, if you compare, say, North Dakota with Colorado, it's orders of magnitude difference. And so here, again, we have a real opportunity to the extent we will continue to use gas for the near term. How do we get those methane loss rates as close to 0.0%, where in many cases we're looking at double-digit numbers of the actual loss? That's a huge part of the challenge. And we have to systematically weigh that as we think about electric vehicles and even further movement from coal toward natural gas, but hopefully also other cleaner energy sources. Great question.
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you. Ross, closing words?
Yep. No, thank you all. And Barry, thank you for your time. We're at 2:35, so it's time for us to close out and head off to the next session. So thank you. I see some of my friends here, and it's great to see you all again. So keep up the great work, and I'm missing everybody really bad right now. So take care. Have a good conference.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.